Welcome to Addressing Current Questions and Emerging Considerations in the Use of PARP Inhibitors in the Management of Ovarian Cancer, a special audio program developed from a satellite CME symposium held at the Society of Gynecologic Oncology's 2019 annual meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, we put together a working group of four community-based oncologists, two gynecologic oncologists and two medical oncologists, and asked them to submit challenging cases of patients with ovarian cancer who had received or were considered for a PARP inhibitor and questions related to the management of these patients. The cases served as a framework for our discussion with the live faculty in Honolulu, Hawaii. The faculty for our program included Professor Jonathan Letterman and Drs. Robert Coleman, Kathleen Moore, and Stephanie LaRue. The first module focused on genomic testing and management of primary ovarian cancer. And to begin, I asked Dr. Moore how she would approach mutation testing for a patient with ovarian cancer who'd undergone initial debulking surgery and whether somatic testing is required in a patient who's germline BRCA negative.
I think that it is the short answer to your question. I think one of the secondary gains from SOLO-1 is it got everybody really thinking more and more and more about testing our patients and identifying BRCA carriers just in general. So hopefully in the United States, we're going to get nearer to 100% testing. We're still learning. I think if you start with a germline test, a panel test, or a straight BRCA test, and that's negative, then I think it's our onus to then do a somatic test to see if they have a somatic BRCA or other mutations in the DNA damage response pathway like RAD51C and others, because at least for BRCA, and really there is data for RAD51C, those patients respond, not only respond to PARP inhibition, but they respond just as well as germline. And so you miss about 7% of patients, which doesn't sound like a lot, but really in an era of individualized therapy, this is what we're trying to do. So we think the practice of doing some kind of germline panel first, followed by or in conjunction with a somatic test, makes the most sense. It's not the most cost effective necessarily, and we can talk about that, but if someone's negative on the germline, I think that they warrant a somatic test.
A real quick question from the audience, Katie. Quote, germline testing up front is a given, but when is somatic testing most valuable, up front or with recurrence? And kind of sounds like you're saying you need to do it up front, Katie?
I really do think you need to do it up front. I don't have all the answers on how to operationalize this yet. I think this is a conversation that is difficult because there's different payers and certainly different countries have different rules. But we really feel like from the recurrent data, the somatic patients benefit just as much. So I know there are only two somatic patients on SOLO-1, but there is no reason to think that they don't benefit just as much from frontline PARP inhibitor as they do in the recurrent setting.
Well, plus you have the indication.
So and you have the indication.
You can give it.
So I really feel like it's only 7%, but I want to know who they are so I can get them the right therapy. And the right therapy for them is a PARP inhibitor is frontline maintenance. I don't want to wait and figure it out later once they've recurred. I want to optimize their chance of being cured, and if not cured, living as long as they possibly can disease-free, and I think that's PARP in the frontline, and the only way you figure that out is by doing both right now.
So a couple of clinical scenarios. We wanted to pick the faculty's brain about it and yours as well. So we presented a situation where a patient has had suboptimal debulking, but has a BRCA germline mutation, and we figured that the majority of people certainly would incorporate a PARP inhibitor, particularly olaparib, and you can see 75%. But what we were really curious about, Stephanie, was the issue whether Bev would be part of the occasion. Of course, we said regulatory and reimbursement issues aside, because I know things might be different in Canada, Europe, and the United States, but we're kind of thinking about pure clinical science right now. Stephanie, how would you think through this issue of a patient who's got a BRCA germline mutation with suboptimally debulking, chemo, olaparib, or maybe integrate Bev?
So it's a good question. I think regarding the data that we have from SOLO-1, I understand that most of the people will give to the patient carboplatin, paclitaxel, and olaparib. There's also some data from ICON-7 that was already published, and we know that the patient who have a suboptimal surgery, adding bevacizumab to the chemotherapy also prolong the overall survival. So it's why I think probably the question will be, what is about adding bevacizumab? And this current trial actually that will access this specific question, do we need to add a PAR plus bevacizumab in this first line patient in this specific population?
So Rob, again, how would you approach a patient like this?
I would do as the audience did. I would give tax carbo followed by a olaparib. In 2018, you know, many people remember that the chemotherapy arm with bevacizumab followed by a placebo did not show any benefit. So it's a question about whether or not we're gaining anything by adding it. However, with PELA 1 coming out, we may have be able to answer the question of the fifth choice there about adding them both.
And we actually see in our tours around the country, there are people, you know, who are doing that now.
Yeah,
I mean,
no doubt.
In advance of that trial, I guess we know it's safe, but we certainly don't know whether it's a better choice. So this next question, really, I don't know why I never thought about this, but it came out in the first case that we heard when we started talking to these docs. And when you think about it, it makes perfect sense. Okay, the data came out from the SOLO-1 trial in November. What about patients who've already had their chemo, but, you know, maybe 6 months later, a year later? What about using delayed therapy? I remember when the trastuzumab adjuvant trials came out in breast cancer, everybody was all panicked. So we tried to add trastuzumab, and these people have already had chemotherapy in the past. Of course, that goes away after a couple years. But right now, Katie, we're kind of in this intermediate zone. I'm curious about how long a patient might have been from surgery that you would still, again, outside a reimbursement issue. Before you answer the question, Katie, what is the track of recurrence in the first couple of years after debulking surgery? What fraction occurs after 6 months, after a year, after 2 years?
So on SOLO-1, and we have to remember, on SOLO-1 is the first time we've ever prospectively studied patients with BRCA mutations. All other data was from epidemiologic data. So this is prospectively collected data and really gives us some accurate information on how our patients do. We demonstrated a hazard ratio of 0.3 in favor of maintenance olaparib, so a 70% reduction in the risk of recurrence. And the landmark analysis we kind of look at is based on the Kaplan-Meier estimates at 3 years, we had 60% of patients on olaparib progression-free as compared to only 26% progression-free on placebo. And surprising to me was that 20% of that population on the placebo arm recurred at 6 months or less. So they're platinum resistant, just like all of our patients. We still had a 20% platinum resistant rate, which I thought would have been lower. And by 1 year, 50% had recurred. And then the slope starts to flatten a little bit. And the olaparib curve, of course, looks entirely different. So we lose that big shoulder at the beginning by using olaparib.
Of course, we don't have prospective data on what happens when you use a delayed PARP inhibitor such as olaparib, but Katie, would you expect that at any given point it would cut the recurrence rate by 70%, for example?
Yeah, I don't think we can say that. That is one of the most common emails I get from providers right now across the country is, I have someone who's 6 months out and she really wants olaparib, should I start it? And we just don't have an answer. I think that my guesstimate is that the benefit of using a maintenance PARP inhibitor is different than the benefit of using maintenance bevacizumab, where you're really kind of honing in on those high-risk patients that probably have markedly elevated VEGF and other pathways kind of in play. The benefit, if you look at the difference in the two curves, it seems to be early. Like, you're losing that shoulder, and the curve is relatively flat. So it may have something to do with the impact on the clonality of the tumor kind of right at the end of chemotherapy. I mean, I can't say we've cured patients, but that's the hope. I mean, the morphology of that curve tells us, I think, that this is an earlier benefit that then is maintained over time. And so does that mean you have to start within 3 months? Can I do it within 6 months? I don't know that we can definitively say that.
Well, you may not be able to definitively say it, but I'm always curious about what people are actually doing. And when they email you and say it's been 6 months, do you say that's okay? Or you say, I don't think that's a good idea?
I mean, I would do it.
You would do it. Okay. So, Jonathan, up to how long? We heard about this pretty substantial recurrence rate over the first couple of years. How long is the latest where you would start delayed olaparib, Jonathan?
Well, I think, you know, the effect of olaparib here is very much in the maintenance setting. And as Katie has said, you're building on the effects of what has happened in chemotherapy and the residual disease that remains after chemotherapy. And the longer you wait, one of two things will happen. Either the tumor is regrowing, in which case it's questionable whether the maintenance olaparib in that situation is going to provide the same sort of effect we saw in SOLO-1, or the patient is going to be part of that population that flattens off, as Katie had said, in the terms of the progression-free survival curve and will do very well with a BRCA mutation, in which case they probably don't benefit from the olaparib. So without the information, which we certainly don't have, I would be uncomfortable about recommending starting olaparib 6 months after the end of chemotherapy. I think, you know, 3 to 4 months is probably the ceiling that I would recommend starting maintenance olaparib in this situation.
The first case from our working group was a woman in her mid-60s with stage 3C serous fallopian tube carcinoma and a germline BRCA1 mutation. The patient presented a year after completing cytoreductive surgery and post-op chemotherapy, and when the results of the SOLO-1 trial had been published, the patient requested and was treated with maintenance olaparib and did well. The patient had also been treated with bilateral prophylactic mastectomies, and the question was whether PARP inhibitors in these patients would decrease the risk of breast cancer and if prophylactic mastectomies are advisable.
I think it's a really good question. We currently, to my knowledge, do not have any data to support that PARP inhibitor would decrease the risk of breast cancer. So I think in this specific patient, she's mid-60s, so the benefit of mastectomy when she have stage 3C high-grade serous ovarian cancer should be discussed. In terms of PARP and breast cancer, the recent data we have is with talazoparib, showing a benefit in breast cancer, germline BRCA. But in terms of prevention, we currently do not have sufficient data to have a specific answer to this question.
So, Jonathan, one other question, which is the question, again, this came up from a number of the docs, of what kind of mutation will get you to use olaparib in the SOLO-1 setting? So we asked the audience, how about PALB2? And we say, putting aside regulatory issues, and it looks like 3/4 of the audience would consider olaparib in a patient with a PALB2 germline mutation. Jonathan, agree or disagree?
Well, I think it's a difficult one because, you know, we're making these decisions not based on any definite evidence of benefit. But having said that, we know that patients with germline PALB2 mutations are susceptible to the development of ovarian cancer and therefore probably have HR deficiency and therefore may well benefit from a PARP inhibitor. And of course, we're just looking over the horizon to data which we hope will appear later this year in the first line setting using either olaparib or niraparib in patients who don't have a BRCA mutation. And we're expecting and hoping that this will show a benefit of maintenance of PARP inhibitor in that setting. So I think there's a very sound feeling reason to use a PARP inhibitor in someone with a PALB2 mutation, but we have to be aware at the moment we don't have the evidence.
The next case we discussed was a woman in her late 60s with stage 3 high-grade serous ovarian cancer. The patient was found to have a BRCA1 Q780 mutation of unknown significance, and the question was whether this patient would be sensitive to a PARP inhibitor, i.e. maintenance olaparib, in the first-line setting.
No.
That's a pretty simple answer.
Yeah, there you go.
I would encourage her to go on clinical trial. We fortunately are in a position right now where we have 5 open frontline studies, all of which have a PARP inhibitor involved. And so, I mean, that's how we're going to learn whether or not this benefits patients. But, you know, that's how, to your other question, Neil, about the other mutations, because patients went on Ariel 2 and Ariel 3, we actually have enough data to talk about RAD51C, mm-hmm. both mutations and methylations, so that I will fight for a patient off study if I need to, because I've got data now because she went on a study. If we're just treating these patients willy-nilly off of clinical trials, no one learns anything and this field doesn't move forward. So I would not do that.
Of course, as Jonathan said, hopefully, I mean, certainly the hazard rate for the recurrent setting for BRCA germline and the SOLO-1 setting was literally identical. So hopefully if we see the same thing with, you know, BRCA wild type, we'll see benefit and all these questions are going to go away.
In the second module, we discussed the role of PARP inhibitors in the management of relapsed ovarian cancer and asked the audience what they would recommend to a patient who's BRCA wild type and experiences disease relapse 10 months after receiving adjuvant carboplatin paclitaxel following debulking surgery. About 25% of the audience would offer such a patient a carboplatin doublet and bevacizumab without a PARP inhibitor, and about 75% would use a PARP inhibitor in maintenance setting. I asked Dr. Coleman for his thoughts.
So I think there's actually a very strong bias towards using the PARP inhibitor. But, you know, in the wild-type patient, you know, as we define them as real wild-type, this is non-HRD, non-BRCA, I don't know that we have a really strong signal with PARP inhibitor, even though the trials, as they have been written, will look for an intent-to-treat population. But if you isolate the truly negatives, I don't see that the signal there is that strong. And so I will go, you know, based on the OCEANS data and GOG-213 for the top one.
So we also asked the BRCA germline situation. I'm kind of curious what people would choose at first relapse. The majority of the audience would use carbo doublet followed by a PARP inhibitor. Looks like more usage of olaparib than the other two, but substantial with the other two. We also asked the question of what about PARP inhibitor at some point in time? So relapse disease, Stephanie, but the patient's BRCA wild type, they're HRD negative. We were trying to ask, you know, you get farther down the line, you start to run out of options, would you use a PARP inhibitor? Stephanie, the majority audience says yes. Do you agree?
I think we are all very excited about PARP inhibitor treatment because it's true, like it's a new treatment that really show a big difference in our patient. As Rob say, if it's a truly BRCA wild type HRD negative with multiple line of treatment, we are probably in the platinum resistant setting. The chance to respond for PARP inhibitor is not high. So it's where definitely I think in the specific situation, multiple line, platinum resistant, truly wild type, the combination is really something we need to look at it.
You know, we're just asking the same kind of questions you ask people. We know you have to individualize it to the particular patient, but kind of just generally asking what people would do. We are also curious if you're going to use it, because we have data, obviously, with all three, which one? A lot of the audience says no preference, and you can see people a little bit split. But we're also interested, Jonathan, about this issue of dosing of niraparib. I think the first time we started to hear about that was a year ago here at this meeting. So we presented what's now becoming a classic case of a woman who's under 177 pounds, normal platelet count. The audience is pretty well on board with 200 milligrams. And looks like there was more data that was presented at this meeting on the question. Still seems like this model holds. Is that your take, Jonathan?
I think that's the case. I think we were all very concerned about the early onset of neutropenia in patients on 300 milligrams and were then very reassured by the radar data. And I think we've sort of extrapolated that to virtually all patients, and certainly my practice will be almost entirely to treat with 200 milligrams, irrespective of the platelet count or the weight. And it was reassuring to see that actually when you look at the progression-free survival in relation to the dose that patients had, there didn't seem to be any difference. So I think that 200 milligrams daily is an effective dose, and it's certainly more tolerable. We see less myelosuppression at that dose.
So, Katie, quick question from the audience. Do patients develop somatic BRCA mutations over time? We're used to our discussions, chronic lymphocytic leukemia. They have to repeat the markers each time because people can develop 17p, p53. Katie, do we know anything about whether people acquire somatic BRCA mutations with time?
I actually don't know the data on that. I think that with ovary cancer, there's a few studies that look at sort of temporal heterogeneity with biopsies over time. And we've done this with HRD, which of course remains stable because it's not really a functional test, it's more a scar test. But the mutations tend to stay fairly stable over time. So I don't really think you acquire BRCA mutations. I've never seen that, but I'm going to defer to Rob.
See, anyhow,
he usually knows more than me about
this. I just want to congratulate the person on asking the question Katie wasn't sure about the answer for, but let's just move on. We'll get kind of to the cases.
The next case we discussed was a woman in her mid-60s with stage 3C papillary serous ovarian cancer who was BRCA germline wild type. The patient relapsed 10 months after receiving primary debulking surgery, followed by carboplatin paclitaxel, and was treated with carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab for 6 cycles, followed by bevacizumab maintenance for 9 months. She's now in an ongoing complete response, and the question was about how long the bevacizumab should be continued.
I think we're going to hear the information about the BOOST trial, which many of you may remember was the kind of the doubling of the use of bevacizumab after the duration of time of bevacizumab in those patients who had received it in frontline. That's a really important trial because if you guys remember, both ICON-7 and 218 did demonstrate this benefit that actually was lost when the drug was withdrawn. And so in the frontline setting, obviously, there's always the issue about whether or not the toxicities are appropriate for long-term and potentially curable patients. In the recurrent setting, I think the same kind of idea would apply, but we know that those patients will ultimately recur, and they recur even on Bev. So in 213, we did not put an upper limit on the Bev. We have several patients that are still on Bev. That trial's been closed to the chemotherapy arm for several years now. And so basically I do what I'm sure most of you do, which is evaluate them for safety and tolerance. And I would continue to use it as long as they got that.
The next case was a woman in her late 50s with a BRCA1 germline mutation that was detected after the diagnosis of triple-negative breast cancer. She was then found to have stage 3 high-grade serous ovarian cancer during a prophylactic oophorectomy and was treated with debulking surgery and carboplatin, but presented with a massive pleural effusion 6 months later. The patient received olaparib monotherapy, had a resolution of the effusion, and didn't require further treatment. The question that was posed was whether or not it's generally possible to achieve good tumor control in patients with BRCA germline mutations treated with PARP inhibitor monotherapy in those who have pleural effusions or ascites.
So for this patient, with a little bit of a disadvantage because we don't have all the data, but I'd be curious whether or not this was truly an ovarian cancer recurrence or a triple negative breast recurrence. I imagine all I had was cytology, and it can be very difficult to tell based on cytology. And we know in triple negative breast, at least talazoparib has an indication. So
does olaparib.
You know, this may have been, it's a little unclear to me actually what's driving this. Typically in ovary cancer, we've never broken down responses in any of the studies based on ascites like we have in post-hoc analyses with bevacizumab. So I wouldn't say that I've seen patients with big responses to monotherapy PARP inhibition who present with massive effusions, because honestly, I probably would have picked a different regimen for them.
So yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes things work that you maybe don't expect.
The next case from our working group was a woman in her early 80s who was BRCA germline wild type and treated with debulking surgery and carboplatin paclitaxel for peritoneal serous adenocarcinoma. The patient had a relapse 3 years later and received carboplatin paclitaxel, but recurred again 6 months later. She was also treated with niraparib at a dose of 300 milligrams a day, but had to be dose reduced to 100 milligrams daily due to thrombocytopenia. The patient had an excellent response and is now PET negative, and I asked Professor Letterman how he would manage the situation.
Well, this is the question really of platinum resistance or not, and we've recently just gone through this in the European Society of Medical Oncology and European Society of Gyne-Oncology and developed some guidelines which are just in press with Annals of Oncology, looking at this question of platinum resistance, and really I think take a much more liberal view that patients are not platinum resistant unless they are resistant to platinum. Platinum is still one of the best, if not the best, chemotherapy drug that we have. So in this sort of situation, I would use chemotherapy in the first instance, and if the patient then responds to platinum-based chemotherapy, would use a PARP inhibitor as maintenance. So that would be my line of approach until I was certain that this patient had platinum resistance.
What about this issue, Katie, of efficacy of niraparib at the lower dose? This patient seemed to respond very well. What do we know about correlation of niraparib dose, Katie, and dose in general of PARP inhibitors and efficacy?
So niraparib is an interesting drug, and I think the PRIMA data will be incredibly important once we have the efficacy to correlate with starting dose. But niraparib is an interesting drug as compared to at least the two others that we most commonly are referring to, olaparib and rucaparib, because it's once daily. The half-life is 34 hours, so it's very long-lived. Its volume of distribution is very large as compared to the other two, and its dose exposure is, I don't want to say inconsistent, but it's very much overlapping. And so you have patients on 100 milligrams who are still in a dose exposure level that's equivalent to patients who are on 300 milligrams. So there seems to be some individualization of what patients need, and the platelets may be telling us sort of how much they need, although I may be stretching a little bit. So with niraparib in particular, if you dose reduce according to hematologic toxicity, you kind of get the patients to the right dose for them. And the efficacy, at least on post-hoc analysis, we have to be careful, doesn't seem to change. Like, they seem to have the same benefit. I don't think we can say right now that, oh, I can start at 100 and the efficacy is going to be the same. I think we have to be very careful with that message. The PRIMA prospective data, the post-amendment data, I think will give us some reassurance there. But when you dose modify appropriately, it does not appear to impact efficacy. And I think the same is true for olaparib and rucaparib. We just haven't seen the same degree of dose modification required, except in rucaparib with the liver enzymes, mm-hmm. but we still saw good efficacy there.
In the third module, we talked about prevention and management of PARP inhibitor-associated side effects. we presented a case from our working group of a woman in her mid-50s with multiply recurrent high-grade serous ovarian cancer and a BRCA1 germline mutation. The patient was treated with olaparib 300 milligrams twice daily and experienced nausea, vomiting, and dyspepsia after 3 weeks of therapy. Treatment was then held for a week and resulted in marked symptom improvement, after which olaparib was restarted at a reduced dose. The patient was administered preemptive ondansetron and is currently faring well. Dr. Brosnan's question related to the role of prophylactic antiemetics.
So in my practice, actually, I offer prophylactic antiemetics for my patients, specifically for the first 1 or 2 months. What I find is that the patient usually just finished chemotherapy. Based on the trial, we usually start the PARP inhibitor maintenance within 8 weeks of the last dose of chemo. They're still recovering. So usually I advise the patient to take initially, systematically, an antiemetic. And then I usually, after 1 or 2 months, people get used to the treatment and they can stop the antiemetic. In terms of type of antiemetic, I usually avoid ondansetron. I find that it's given a lot of constipation to our patient. So I usually use another type of antiemetic to avoid the constipation related to ondansetron.
We asked the audience, okay, you have a patient who has a BRCA germline mutation, who's getting olaparib after debulking surgery. And Stephanie, we asked the audience, what's the chance that the patient's going to require some kind of dose reduction or delay because of nausea and vomiting with GI toxicity? Looks like the audience is kind of hanging around the 10 to 20% range. Stephanie, in your mind, what's the likelihood and what are the data show in terms of that?
I think what is important regarding the choice of the PARP inhibitor treatment is know how to manage it. So more we use it, more we know how to manage it. And in terms of nausea and vomiting, I think it's probably less than 10%. The thing is, it's probably the preventive antiemetic, I think, is something that usually I advise my patient.
So I just want to alert you to this paper that was just published in January by Lancet Oncology. Rob is the senior author. It is really a spectacular paper. It's one of the best review articles I've ever read in oncology, period. Really, congratulations to Rob and his team. What a fantastic review, Rob. There's so many interesting things in that paper. But the first thing, Rob, is I noticed you used the term synthetic sickness.
Yeah.
And we've been used to synthetic lethality. Yeah. Why did you use this term?
Yeah, so it's because, you know, synthetic lethality, as it's been traditionally described, is really the occurrence of two mutations leading to a synthetic lethal event in the cell. And so if you think about it, PARP inhibitors, if the PARP gene leads to an altered enzyme because of the mutation, PARP doesn't actually bind. So it actually is a mechanism of PARP resistance. So I didn't like the term synthetic lethality to describe what we talk about, the mechanism of action.
Well, yeah, I'm still stuck on the table with four legs, and you take off one leg, and you take off two legs in terms of
That's
mechanism.
Okay.
But although that was cool. The other thing that was in the paper that I thought was interesting is you were commenting on the issue of PARP and circadian rhythm. Mm-hmm. And we were talking in the faculty room about the issue, which I had never really heard before, about insomnia. Mm-hmm. So PARP inhibitors affect with the circadian neural circuits or what?
Yeah, so I was given a talk at a place one time and we had recognized that insomnia and fatigue were common side effects. But this fellow came up to me and said, listen, you know, we've been studying PARP1 and we realized that PARP1 actually is one of the enzymes that helps to regulate the natural circadian rhythm. And with under therapy, under PARP inhibition, the circadian rhythm features that they were able to monitor in the blood, different peptides and enzymes were actually affected by that. And so the hypothesis is that some of this may be the insomnia, which is very frequently recorded by patients as not a very high grade, but present, could be, you know, related to this mechanism.
So, yeah, we were talking, Jonathan, you know, about the issue of insomnia in patients on PARP inhibitors. Is that maybe related to fatigue? Do you see insomnia, Jonathan, in your patients?
I think it is to some degree because if people can't sleep, they get fatigue. But I think it's a very separate side effect and one that actually increasingly I'm becoming aware of patients reporting difficulty in sleeping. And I've tried with some of the PARP inhibitors, particularly the niraparib taken once a day, to look at it in different times of the day. It actually hasn't, in my experience, made any difference in terms of sleeping.
Yeah, I just think it's maybe something to keep in mind as you talk to your patients.
The next case we discussed was a woman in her mid-60s with multiply recurrent ovarian cancer treated with rucaparib monotherapy. The patient tolerated it well initially, but within weeks experienced a doubling of the serum creatinine. The question from the working group related to how this patient would be managed and what further workup would be advisable.
So this would be grade 2 toxicity. She's 1.5 from baseline. So And you see this with rucaparib. Actually, you have 90% of patients on rucaparib have an increase in creatinine. It doesn't always become grade 1 or 2. The rate of grade change is a little bit lower. It's like in the 20s to 30s, but it's pretty common, and it is related to that transporter. So if patients are on something and doing well, I tend to be a little more aggressive. So I would work her up. I'd make sure she doesn't have the common things, like she said, you know, give her vancomycin recently, or do something stupid like that. You know, I get a renal ultrasound, make sure we don't have some new progression that's causing hydronephrosis. And then I check a GFR, and if her GFR is normal and the creatinine's not continuing to rise, I tend to ride it out. I think Rob has more experience with this particular agent than me, so it kind of bumps up and then it just stays the same. It doesn't keep rising. It's not a cumulative sort of thing. So if it bumps up and then it just stays the same, that's the drug. And I would actually keep treating, and I probably wouldn't dose reduce somebody. I don't think it's wrong, but if it's just the drug, you're not causing renal damage. So I'd work it up. I don't know that I would necessarily send to nephrology unless I really had some kind of question, but I don't think that's wrong either.
In the last module, we talked about investigational approaches with PARP inhibitors and discussed the case of a woman in her mid-50s who was BRCA germline wild type with stage 4 mixed clear cell and serous ovarian cancer. She was enrolled in the phase 3 GOG-3005 VELIA trial and received carboplatin paclitaxel veliparib after debulking surgery, followed by maintenance veliparib. The patient presented 2 years later with an isolated recurrence in the brain and was treated with stereotactic radiation therapy followed by carboplatin, PLD, and niraparib. The question from the working group related to the ability of PARP inhibitors to cross the blood-brain barrier and their efficacy in the CNS. The other question was whether patients who had experienced progression on one PARP inhibitor could respond to another.
Yeah, so I'll start with the easy one first. So CNS, there was sort of uncertainty about the blood-brain barrier penetration for PARP inhibitors for a while, and niraparib was really the first to show in animal models that they crossed, and so I think we kind of went to that one first, and that's true. I think now we know they all cross the blood-brain barrier, so I don't really think there's a tremendous difference, and we're actually testing PARP inhibitors in glioblastoma now, so certainly they have CNS penetration and should be active agents for this class of patients. So it sounds like she was completely appropriately treated. In terms of PARP after PARP, we did present my fellow who's sitting right in the front row, because she's awesome, Dr. Essel, presented a very small study, multi-institutional study yesterday, where we tried to look at patients who had received two or more lines of PARP inhibition. And it's very small, and so we can only make sort of some hypotheses, but we did see responses to repeat use of PARP, very much like this patient received. And the patients who did respond, and it's small numbers, so we have to be cautious, but they were all patients who had BRCA mutations, and they were all patients who were exposed to PARP as part of their frontline therapy on clinical trials.
Germline mutations?
Were they all germline? Yeah.
So, Jonathan, I think this is the most important thing I've heard in the last couple of days about PARP and of this question, because I think there's some new data on this now. So, Jonathan, how do you answer this question? Looks like the audience is pretty split. Do you see a benefit of a second PARP inhibitor a la breast cancer, where we can use sequential hormonal therapies? Yes or no, Jonathan?
Well, you know, I think we use PARP inhibitors mostly now in recurrent disease until progression. And so the reason those patients progress is they become resistant to PARP inhibitor. So it would be unusual, I think, to see patients responding again to a PARP inhibitor in that setting, which is different from the first line setting where we use a PARP inhibitor in SOLO-1 for just 24 months and then stop.
We also asked the audience, this relates to this case, is the issue of PARP inhibitors and CNS mets. Most of the audience think there's really no preference one way or the other. There are people who think olaparib and niraparib are. So one other question, Rob, you know, we know in targeted therapy and lung cancer and many other cancers that there's this concept of sort of an escape lesion. Mm-hmm. And you hear people say, okay, they're doing well on an ALK inhibitor or EGFR or whatever it might be, and then they break through. They've been doing well. They break through with one lesion. Do you consider this, you know, progressive disease and switch therapy, or do you like take it out, irradiate it, and keep going? This was a patient. She had BRCA germline. She ended up 7 years after initial diagnosis getting olaparib as a single agent. She was on it for 2 years. She responded. She did well, tolerating. And boom, she shows up with an adrenal met on imaging. They took it out. and kept the olaparib going, as sort of that escape type of concept. Rob, is that the way you approach patients like this?
Yeah, I probably would do that. I probably would put her back on. I think that, you know, we know that there's some tumor heterogeneity, and since it's been resected, I probably would restudy it.
The next topic was discussed by Dr. LaRue, the use of PARP inhibitors in combination with anti-angiogenic agents and immunotherapy.
In terms of PARP inhibitor and anti-angiogenic, it's an active area of investigation. We know that bevacizumab is active in ovarian cancer. There's different trials currently ongoing assessing PARP and bevacizumab. One phase 2 trial that was presented at ESMO in 2017 with niraparib and bevacizumab showed it was feasible and safe, and we're currently awaiting the result of the randomized phase 2. There's other antiangiogenic, for example, cediranib, which is broader activity in terms of the antiangiogenic. And when we compare olaparib to the combination olaparib and cediranib, this is significant in terms of PFS and overall survival, specifically and uniquely for the patient BRCA wild type. And as we know, by combination, we increase the side effect, and the side effects were mainly fatigue, diarrhea, and hypertension. Now, we also move forward with a combination of PARP and immune therapy. Why? Because when you have a DNA repair deficiency, you have intrinsic immunogenicity. How? Because you have this upregulation of the STING and NF-kappa-B pathway. Moreover, when you treat the patient with a PARP inhibitor treatment, you induce PD-L1. So that is a rationale to combine the two. And in the specific population of BRCA1 deficiency, we know that they have a higher neoantigen load. And there's different trial that has been done, and a lot of still ongoing, olaparib and pembrolizumab, the phase 1 has been done, and there's some interesting early activity in platinum resistance with a response rate about 25%. Another one, Mediola, it was a basket trial assessing olaparib and durvalumab. Again, it seems to be safe and some early activity that we need to be further validated. And the trial is still ongoing with a new arm assessing the triplet, olaparib, durvalumab, and bevacizumab. That's an exciting area that we need to follow for our patients.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty and to our community oncologist working group, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Addressing Current Questions and Emerging Considerations with the Use of PARP Inhibitors in the Management of Ovarian Cancer.